Hello, I'm Niall Kahn, and this is the PPRO Podcast. Every other week, I sit down with James Booth to discuss the latest innovations, investments, and acquisitions that have taken place over the last weeks. James, welcome back.
Good morning, Niall.
This week on the show, we have a lot of interesting news going on. Let's kick off with some talk about instant payments in the U.S. There's been some speculation that as the federal government in the U.S. is trying to kick off the instant payments scheme there, a lot of the fintech companies are feeling threatened.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good thing. I mean, the US is in desperate need of an instant payment system, just like the EU, the UK, Australia, Japan, kind of all of these other geographies. But there are several fintechs in the US that obviously thrive off the fact that the infrastructure is lacking. So I'm pretty sure that they do feel threatened because it's their entire reason for being in business. However, I think that's probably just a defensive comment that they're making, because long term, this probably gives them more benefit and more value into the system. You look at wallets or products such as Venmo or the Cash app. Those apps were pretty much just built solely for that purpose, to send instant payments peer to peer between friends, etc. Now the Fed will come in and obviously build an entire network off the back of that, but I don't think they need to worry that much. If you look at how slowly these things get up and running, and even though it may be a government-led thing that the entire industry can integrate into, in reality, not everybody integrates into these systems. It takes them years to do so. So if anything, I think fintechs stand to gain the most out of something like this. It'll just allow them to probably turbocharge their offering today and even offer additional services off the back of that. I mean, it's similar to the whole open banking initiative in the UK and the EU. I think most of the fintechs here are seeing it as an opportunity rather than a threat, because let's be honest, none of the big banks here are really doing much with it. They're integrating into these schemes just to get on a level par, but they're not really doing anything kind of forward focused and kind of thinking down the line.
That's really interesting. So just for a little bit of background, the instant service will be called FedNow, and it should actually be available in 2023 or 2024. The private banks through the clearinghouse have actually already created this instant payment system in November of 2017. So this has already actually existed for quite some time in the U.S. It just hasn't been on a federal level, it seems.
And I mean, it's cool having this Fed-led initiative, but at the end of the day, you have to see where the consumers are. And at the moment, all of the young consumers, all of the millennial consumers, would probably prefer to use Venmo or Zelle or the Cash app, etc. And they're kind of already bought into these ecosystems. So as long as they can continue building products off the side of these systems, I don't see them moving back to old traditional banking apps to make peer-to-peer payments. I spent a year in the US last year. I won't name who I banked with, but that banking app was probably one of the worst experiences I've ever had in a UX. And I actually, all of my online payments, online banking, all of the services that I used were all fintech-led services. I used Venmo, I used PayPal. I kind of used those more than my actual bank. So, I don't see big banks really utilizing this. I think if the same thing happens in the US, that's happened in the UK and the EU with all of these, with the rise of all of these neobanks, I think the neobanks stand a lot to gain. And obviously the Venmos of the world, I think they probably should be more threatened by the rise of a neobank than by the rise of this FedNow service. Because if it's open, they can all integrate into it. They just need to make sure that they're the best.
Now, I always find it really striking that in the U.S., it's very uncommon to use bank-to-bank transfer for consumers. It's usually if you have to, like, buy a house or something, you will use a bank-to-bank transfer. But it's not so much consumer-focused like it is in the EU and the U.K. Do you know why that legacy is there?
I mean, I think because the experience is so bad. I mean, when you pay one of your friends using a bank-to-bank transfer, it's going to take several days. So it's much easier to draw cash and almost pay them in person. And that's why the rise of apps like Venmo and Cash App, et cetera, exist, just because it's speeding up and kind of bypassing the banking infrastructure. So now the creation of this real-time payment service, it would in essence put a bank's kind of speed of transfer at the same level to that of a Venmo or a Cash App, etc. And that's probably why they feel threatened. But in reality, the banks are still, I mean, they still have to deal with all this old legacy kind of software and infrastructure, and they still have to rebuild these old horrible apps where kind of the fintechs, they've got so much more potential and opportunity to build good services off the back of a platform like this.
I was just going to say, I first heard about Venmo and the Cash App through podcasting. So, of course, if FedNow service is listening, we would be happy to take their sponsorship.
Good plug. But it's going to be interesting to see how this pans out. It's happening everywhere else in the world. So, yeah, the U.S. just has to catch up. Otherwise, banks from other countries will just come in and kind of eat their breakfast over a 10, 20-year period. I mean, Monzo, which is a UK neobank, has already decided that they're launching in the US. N26, which is a German neobank, has also launched in the US. So there's a lot of them kind of jumping over the pond and launching services there because they know that the current banking consumer products are not good enough. And it's very easy for them to almost copy-paste their applications in the US. Obviously, they have to go through the whole licensing procedure, which can take a long time. But essentially, their services today are already so much better than that of banks. So the US fintechs probably should be a bit worried, but they've got a head start compared to everybody else. So they should be building in services that consumers want.
James, that is the exact opposite of what you said in the beginning. You said at first they shouldn't be afraid, now they should be afraid.
Well, actually, maybe not afraid. Maybe afraid is the wrong term. They should be motivated by this to build out their products. I mean, at the end of the day, Venmo is a very basic product. It hasn't changed in a long time. Now is maybe the perfect time for them to build on top of that. If they don't do anything, yeah, they'll probably die out over a period of time.
And how does Venmo actually make real-time payments work? Because they're obviously not using the banking system, so they just basically created their own rail system.
It's pretty much like an e-wallet. So you insert funds into the PayPal network, you load it through a bank transfer or a card payment, etc. And then you're effectively just transferring money from one Venmo wallet to another Venmo wallet. So cash is actually not leaving PayPal. It's just kind of a digital balance is moving from one account to the other. It's when the whole process slows down, when it leaves one organization or one bank to the other. With Venmo or cash or all of the other services, they're just staying within the same e-wallet.
Okay. Oh, that's very interesting. Let's move on to our next subject here. Last week, we talked about IMSA. It's the European Mobile Payment Systems Association, and they're, of course, working on standardizing a QR code for across Europe, it seems. Another country is also doing this at the moment, which is the Philippines. And obviously, the Philippines is a massive market for e-commerce. There's unprecedented growth there. There's a lot of interesting different local payment methods there. Why are the Philippines doing this now?
I mean, I think it's definitely more relevant for the Philippines than Europe at this point in time. Obviously, IMSA, which I believe was Blue Code Twins Mobile Pay, so Switzerland, Denmark, Belgium, etc. For them, I think they're maybe thinking quite far into the future once QR codes are more adopted in Europe. But the Philippines, I mean, I think the whole Southeast Asia region has already widely adopted QR codes as a daily method of payment. So it naturally makes sense for them to standardize QR code payments between different e-wallet providers, different point-of-sale software and systems. For them, it's a complete no-brainer. I'm sure ever since Alibaba or Alipay announced the first initiative like this several months ago, they've probably been working on that since then because there'll probably be immediate traction for something like this in the Philippines.
Yeah, as you said, the Philippines is not the first country in Southeast Asia to do this. We also have Singapore, Indonesia, and Malaysia working on this as well. The standardized QR code.
Exactly, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if at some stage in the future we find there's standardized QR codes on a regional basis, obviously powered by each fintech in the region. And I'm sure, give it a few years, the standardized regional kind of codes will probably regionalize into an entire region. So maybe we have Philippines, we've got Singapore, etc. At some stage, there'll probably be an APAC standardized code, and I wouldn't be surprised if at some stage it was almost like a global QR code mandate that that could generate kind of generic QR codes for any region because it makes sense. Visa, MasterCard, Amex, and all of those providers Yeah, I'm sure they're probably keeping a very close eye on this because it allows more fragmentation in the market when you have these standardized QR codes. Because any fintech can spin up a service and kind of use that standardized QR code as a method of payment and almost have immediate access to thousands or hundreds of thousands of point-of-sale devices.
And that's a really interesting observation. I hadn't thought that it would actually cause more market fragmentation with the standard code, but you're absolutely right. That would make sense. If it's easier to get into the marketplace and it's accessible everywhere, it would make sense that there would be a panoply of different e-wallets now. This is, I guess, maybe the same theory as with credit cards as well, why you have so many different credit card companies, is that it's widely accepted. Each one has their own little flavor or special secret sauce that people like about it. But it's like you said, it's accepted everywhere.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to know if there are any restrictions around it. I would expect today that they would restrict the usage of these QR codes to the providers that are helping develop them. But once they've built them out and once it's scalable, you would hope that they could open it up to other providers, or at least they go through a vetting or a licensing process to use the QR code.
Yeah, we'll have to keep a close eye on that.
Yeah, there's a lot of these. I think we're going to have to keep a tracker of all the different QR code initiatives around the world.
What a fun project for us.
Let's add it to our podcast topic notes.
Deal. Let's tack away from the Philippines and go back to the U.S. and talk about Stripe a little bit. Stripe is one of the world's largest payment service providers. They are growing at an incredible rate. At the moment, they allow businesses to accept payments from 45 countries around the world, but they're breaking into a new market.
Yeah, so they just launched a credit card, one of their many products. Obviously, Stripe's known for SME payments. You can sign up for an account in a few minutes and accept credit card payments and a variety of local payment methods. But over the years, they've been slowly adding additional services on the side and even services that are not directly related to payments. They've got Atlas that allows you to incorporate a Delaware-based business in under 5 minutes. So you can almost just create an internet business out of the box using their Atlas product and then obviously plug in payments into that. Plug in, I think it's Radar, which is their fraud prevention tool, etc. Earlier this year, they launched an issuing toolkit that allows you to kind of dynamically generate or issue prepaid cards, I believe it was. But now they've launched a corporate credit card. Quite cool. If you go back to Stripe's vision, their goal is quite an ambitious goal. It's quite simple. It's just to increase the GDP of the internet. So obviously, their core business is payments, but any additional product that they can bolt onto the side, I think makes their merchants and their users more sticky to the service and it helps them grow their business. So, I mean, offering a corporate credit card to a small online business certainly helps them out. Offering capital to the business through their capital product helps them grow. So I think for them, it's anything that helps their businesses succeed and indirectly generate more volume through payments is a good thing for Stripe. And it's hard to keep up with them because they're just launching new products every quarter. I'm impressed.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the credit card is that there's no interest rate, there's no fees to use the card, and the way that Stripe's actually going to be making the money is through their interchange fee.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for them, they shouldn't worry about late payments or non-payments of any of these credit card bills because they go through such a vetting process to be onboarded as a Stripe customer. I mean, I would doubt I would be able to incorporate a business today and immediately have access to Stripe Capital and the Stripe credit card, etc. They would probably use my transaction history over time to generate a credit profile, to generate almost like a trustworthiness profile. And over time, they would start offering me these additional services that make me more sticky to them. So if I was using them for payments and then I grew and maybe I needed a little bit of capital, they would provide me capital through Stripe Capital. Then I'd be using two products from them now. Then as they see my transactions coming in and my volume growing, or at least my employees are growing, they would offer me a corporate credit card for my sales team. They're now I'm using three of their products. So it's just more and more and more kind of hooks that they're building.
That's a very interesting model. So they're basically creating their own little fintech ecosystem.
Ecosystem, yeah. And anything to loop back to their vision of increasing the GDP. I mean, how do you increase the GDP of the internet? You get merchants to transact more. How do you get merchants to transact more? You help them grow. If you want to help them grow, you need to help them with capital, with payment cards. I mean, you can even go so far as offering them HR services, marketing services, etc. I think they'll probably stay within the finance vertical, but I'm sure this is not the last product we'll see that Stripe launches in the next year.
All right, something else to keep an eye on.
Well, I think moving on from fintechs, big banks in the US are obviously keeping a very close eye on blockchain. So another news story that I found this week was Deutsche Bank has just joined JP Morgan's blockchain initiative. So for those of you that don't know, JP Morgan has they're leading a blockchain-led initiative called the Interbank Information Network, the IIN. And essentially what that is a consortium of banks are all kind of jumping onto a JP Morgan-led blockchain platform really built to help increase the speed of payments between interbank networks, the accuracy, the kind of the scalability, let's say. I think everybody's trying to build something off a blockchain network, and this could be a very good application or a very good use of it. It seems like there's almost two big competitors here. There's the big banks who were at the beginning very anti-blockchain. Now they seem to be very pro-blockchain, and they're actually getting quite good traction. Then there's the fintechs like the Facebooks and their Libra initiative that were very pro-blockchain from day one. But they're the ones that are actually getting scrutinized. The regulators are jumping on top of them. Meanwhile, the big banks are almost just sailing through and getting all of it done. I think it's probably because they're trusted more by the government. Even though something like a Libra, from a consumer perspective, it might be a better product. But the problem is we don't trust Facebook.
Now, James, I confess to understand very little about blockchain. For me, it kind of reminds me of like astrophysics. Like if you understand it, you're wrong. Why would a bank be interested in creating a blockchain infrastructure? If they already have instant payments, they already have SWIFT, they already have the clearinghouse, why would they be interested in creating a new method of payment transfer?
It potentially could be a more stable and more transparent way to transact, because essentially with a blockchain, everybody can view the blockchain and everybody can see the transactions that are flowing through the system. Now, they're all anonymized, so nobody can see who transacted where or what, depending on the setup, but you can see where these transactions are happening, and kind of the entire network verifies all of the payments within the blockchain ledger. So I think in some cases they're hedging their bets, because there is the Fed initiative where they're building their own blockchain rails, not blockchain rails, they're building their own instant payment rails, and then obviously bank-led blockchain rails, and I'm sure there's one or two other initiatives that they're leading. But at the moment, I think they're all racing to try and find the best possible solution. There's SWIFT you can use today to do interbank payments. There's various interbank networks. But I think you always need to continue developing and looking for the next best solution, because I don't think anything's perfect.
As you mentioned, there's now a lot of countries looking into creating their own cryptocurrencies. And a lot of this is because of Facebook's Libra, right? This week, Libra was questioned by the ECB in Basel about what exactly Libra will be, how it will work. And a lot of countries have a lot of reservations about allowing a private corporation to quasi create their own currency. Facebook would, of course, argue that they're not creating their own currency. It'll be pegged to the dollar or the euro. But there's still a lot of reservations from regulators.
Because it's unknown and it's not understood completely, I think a lot of things can change in their implementation. I think they have a clear vision of what they want to create, and it's probably quite a good vision. It's probably and a very honest vision. But the problem with this is if you don't keep a close eye on it, it could morph within the next 6 to 12 months. The direction of the product could change, and who knows where it ends up in 2-3 years without some kind of regulation or some kind of body just monitoring what they're doing. And that's maybe why some of the regulators are leaving the banks alone, because the regulators already have a very close eye on the banks, and the banks are pretty much tied to whatever financial regulator monitors them on a daily basis, whereas Facebook's kind of got a lot of freedom and some would argue a bit too much freedom. Some would argue not enough freedom.
I think most people would also say that about the banks as well, because obviously the banks have caused some economic issues in the last couple of decades with crashes, and their regulators just weren't paying attention to what the banks were doing. It terrifies me that there's a chance that cryptocurrency could also be a failed experiment.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what's going to happen if it crashes? I mean, I think the hope is that it won't crash. But someone like Facebook, that's not run like a bank, it's not regulated like a bank, they have, I mean, a consumer might not have any way to recourse any of those transactions or losses, whereas at least a bank is somehow responsible or somehow regulated to a degree.
What do you feel about it? I'm very against this, I guess, the more I think about this.
I mean, I wouldn't say I'm against it. I'm skeptical of the application of it. I don't know if it's going to provide that much more value to a consumer, because yes, you can create all these cool blockchain rails and blockchain this and blockchain that, but ultimately at the end of the day, consumers have to buy these products. And is it going to make our experience that much better? I mean, is it going to make a payment between my bank account and your bank account quicker or more transparent? I'm very skeptical of that.
And as, you know, on the PPRO podcast, we are always fascinated by the latest innovations in fintech. This week, we found out that Starbucks has launched a completely new payment method that you would have never thought of.
It's a pen.
Thank you, James. Yes, it's a goddamn pen. What the hell?
It's a pen.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very random, but could make a bit of sense. I mean, I've seen this before in the UK. There is
You've seen a pen that can buy things?
Well, not a pen.
I guess if you have a checkbook, it kind of counts as a pen buying things, but
I mean, it's essentially just an NFC chip inside a pen, and Starbucks in Japan have inserted an NFC chip into lots of other goods. They have almost like a little key ring. They have a phone case. I think they also have a coffee mug.
They also have a cute little purse.
Yeah, cute little purse. But the coffee mug is very cool. If you have a Starbucks coffee mug and your Starbucks wallet is connected to that coffee mug,
yeah,
you forget your wallet, you just take your coffee mug there, get it filled up, and pay with your mug. That's quite cool. The pen, yeah, maybe could be very relevant for businessmen if they're doing a lot of work in Starbucks and they don't travel without their pens. It could work.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Sure, yeah.
Yeah. But then why don't you just use your old phone or your mobile wallet? I mean, I think more people will leave their pens at home compared to their mobile phones, unfortunately.
Yeah, certainly. So the phone will cost you approximately 4,000 yen or $37 should you find yourself in Japan and want to buy a cup of coffee with your pen. All right. Well, James, thank you very much again for joining me today.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure.
All right, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks' time.
Perfect. Take it easy.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. If you're enjoying it, make sure to leave a review on iTunes and subscribe on the podcatcher of your choice. If you'd like to stay up to date with PPRO, make sure to follow PPRO on social media at PPRO_payments. And if there are any news stories that you think we missed, make sure to send an email to podcast@ppro.com. The PPRO podcast only sounds good because of Andre Ratke. All right, until next time.